Well, the only reason I teach on this is it just proves in one more area God's Word was right after all. I said to someone of Jewish faith today, you can't believe the roots of your faith, the Old Testament literature, and not believe in the reality of Satan and demon forces. There are some persons out there that it would just as soon we didn't know they were there. So they sneak around and do their evil work. Now, I sort of camped out on Ed and Lorraine Warren because I take a personal satisfaction in pointing out that these Catholic laymen are a little more effective in dealing with real demons than some of the television evangelists who put the Catholics down. I'm not Catholic. I hold to a different position. I believe that every one of us got a pipeline straight to God with no relay stations in between. But I respect them. There'll be a lot of them in heaven. If all Catholics go to hell, as one evangelist preaches, then all the doctrines being preached by most of these television preachers were worked out by people going to hell. Because the Catholic Church councils have worked out most of them. It's ludicrous. I take real delight. You know, here's some evangelist with his microphone talking to him, dumping on tobacco. I mean, the worst demon he's confronted is a cigar. Saying that Jews and Catholics' prayers are not answered. I know what goes up in heaven. I don't even need a revelation. Every so often God says, Jesus. So we turn our hearing aid down so we can shut this din and noise of these TV evangelists off. And let's call a Catholic and talk sense. I mean, at least they know who the enemy is. TV evangelists have been listening to, been shooting the wounded Christians. Shoot for Jesus hit men. So I'm going to read on. Ed and Lorraine, she's clairvoyant, you know. And Ed, he's a demonologist. And somebody said, how do you get to be one? Practicing. That's like asking Patton how you get to be a soldier. Not shoveling down in Tennessee. This does me good to go Christmas shopping, folks. I want you to know that. Shopping too is right. They were speaking on demonology at a college gathering. Some guy brought his girlfriend that was full of the devil. She was possessed right then and there and tried to kill Lorraine. Scared everybody around. They went home with the girl who was named Lonnie and her boyfriend. Now, going out the gate, some of these TV preachers wouldn't be caught dead going home with a boy and girl who weren't married. I mean, they had to spend all their time dealing with the surface things instead of going home dealing with the devil. They're like these cops that put a parking ticket on the bank robber's car outside the bank. They recognized Lonnie was full of the devil, you know. Let's not deal with peripherals. Let's go home and deal with the real problem. Well, I think you've got that, so let's keep going. They called in a Protestant exorcist because they didn't have time to go through the 3 days fasting and prayer and all the details the Catholic Church required. Once in a while, us Protestants with a direct line come in handy when you got to move quick. I mean, if you can't get the Pope on the telephone line, you just go find a Protestant. They dive in where angels fear to trod. And these Protestants exorcised the devil, but before it departed, the thing vowed it would return to another. None of us present had any idea what the Spirit had in mind. Later I'd be the one to find out, Ed says. And that's where I was last night almost. That's better. After the exorcism was over and Lonnie was freed from bondage to this spirit, Ed continues, the girl turned her conjuring crap over to me. He didn't say it quite that way. He took this witchcraft paraphernalia home, put it in his museum. I mean, the man loves to dwell in the midst of competition. He says, he was in the following night after he put the stuff in his museum where he keeps all this stuff he collects after he frees people of the demons they got playing with them. To continue, the following night after sunset, a psychic cold filled the office and the museum where I'd put the objects, sensing the change in temperature. It's getting cold in here. Sensing the change in temperature, I got up from my desk and looked out into the museum. There, by the veil and the horns, part of her paraphernalia was a black lace veil. And goat horns. There by the veil and the horns, Ed says, I saw a dark, gray, cloud-like mass about the size of a man building into a dense, black form. To prevent the thing from manifesting, I used holy water to drive it back into invisibility. Still, it was evident that the entity which possessed Lonnie had traveled along with the profane objects. Ed should have known that. As fate would have it, I received a phone call the next day from a fellow named John Rand, who wanted to make an appointment to come to my office with his daughter Charlene. Why do you need to see me? I asked him. Frustrated and upset, he explained that his daughter possessed a natural knowledge of what he took to be witchcraft. He said, give me a quick run-through of the girl's life, and instead of playing like an ordinary child, Charlene was often found off on her own, performing complicated rituals involving pentagrams, animal blood, and so forth, things a six-year-old would have no familiarity with. As the girl got older, she displayed an aversion to church and withdrew in the presence of clergymen. Meanwhile, neighborhood kids were instinctively frightened of Charlene. Even her own mother was afraid to be left alone in the same room with her. As a teenager, Charlene got even worse. When she stared at people, even when they weren't aware of it, she'd fill their mind with inhuman terror. The girl's gaze was so intense she could actually stop machinery. I can't keep reading. Now, you say, well, how could demons possess little children? Well, they did in the New Testament. Can't believe this, but I do. The girl's gaze was so intense she could actually stop machinery. I know this is true because I later saw her do it. She brought a car moving along a highway to a stone-cold stop. Am I going to lose my credibility as I read on? Nope. These are the people that went to West Point by invitation, exercised a ghost. These are the experts called in on the Amityville horror case. We didn't get to that point last night when we were reading on it. He began to ask her questions. Well, let's go on. We're going to be joining some more people. I'll let them join us. And then I'll keep reading. She brought a car moving along the highway to a stone-cold stop. Yet this activity was not the reason why Rand had called me. Rather, Charlene was now manifesting different personalities. Some male, some female, some that couldn't even be called human. Moreover, the statements these personalities made were extremely threatening to John Rand and his wife. In response, he brought the girl to a psychiatrist who recognized her problem as being something more than psychological. The doctors told him to bring his daughter to a clergyman. Let's play I Want to Know to bring a little bit of security in here. No, we're not playing music. Let's just revolve my face. That's better. That'll bring a sense of security. I'll do a spin while we join Dallas and Fort Worth and some other people. Be right back. 1 minute. My clock's off. No, it isn't. Good, I can read some more. 1 whole minute to go? The doctors told him to bring his daughter to a clergyman, but the minister whom Rand consulted wouldn't see the girl unless he brought her to see me first. This is Ed talking. After listening to the man's problem, I made an appointment to see them both the following Saturday at 11 a.m. That night, the spirit again attempted to manifest in the museum, and again I did my thing with the holy water. The next day, Monday, Lorraine and I left for speaking engagements in Pennsylvania and Ohio and didn't return home until late Friday. The following day, Saturday, at 11 in the morning, John Rand arrived with his daughter for their scheduled appointment. Charlene was about 19. Now, after I do a spin, I'll be right back. These that just joined us, I'm reading the ghost story again. The Demonologist, The Extraordinary Career of Ed and Lorraine Warren by Gerald Brittle. I'm nice. I'm so nice, I make myself sick. These same stations that joined us last night, I decided to wait until they got back to pick up this story that I'd left dangling. Ed and Lorraine Warren are prominent Catholic lay people, demonologists. They've been called in on some of the most amazing, extra-human, preternatural would be their word, events in America. They were called in for the Donovan case, called in for the Devil in Connecticut case, called in for the Amityville horror case, called to West Point with the superintendent. As they were given a lecture there, called over to his place to exorcise a ghost. The credibility of these people is the only thing that keeps me reading it. We're presently involved with another happening that we have some of our people checking into. My purpose is just to report events that are ignored by a skeptical, materialistic world that just closes its mind and says because it's supernatural, it couldn't happen. I'm trying to gestalt an avalanche of evidence from shamanism to a Pentecostal exorcism in Manila, to these Catholic exorcists in between, that opens tight brains to the reality that there are phenomena out there better not be ignored. And once again, the Bible has proven accurate in its analysis of reality. Now, last night I read up to the point where they exercised, through the use of a Protestant exorcist, a girl that had come to one of their lectures, demon-possessed. Came under possession, even tried to attack Lorraine, the clairvoyant wife of Ed, of this demonologist duo. They went to her home, called a Protestant exorcist in that case because they didn't have the time to go through the requirements of Catholic Church approval, exorcised Lonnie with the promise by the thing as it went out that it would return to another. Ed, as was his custom, took home witchcraft paraphernalia that Lonnie had used. And when it was placed in the museum where he keeps those relics, a manifestation occurred the first night. He received a call from a fellow named John Rand who wanted to bring his daughter that had the symptoms of demon possession and had been involved in strange witchcraft practices. And I had read up to that point, not last night, but I think I read up to the first manifestation in Ed's office. I'll go ahead and finish it for you. As the black mass began to materialize, he was able to drive it back. He then received the call. Once again, the next night, another attempt at manifestation. And then he accepts the appointment with this John Rand who brought his daughter to see him. And that's where I was just as we joined the folks in Fort Worth and Dallas and Steubenville and Albuquerque and other places. The following day, Saturday at 11 in the morning, John Rand arrived with his daughter for their scheduled appointment. Charlene was about 19. She was a tall, thin brunette with blue eyes that put out a fierce, penetrating gaze. By the way, we were able to order the little book, The Amityville Horror, that I was reading from last night. We got it on the way, that we know. We're still fighting to get the demonologist. I'm now willing to print it in hardback if necessary so I can give it away. Now, if the Amityville Horror arrives in time, we'll give it away Sunday, if not the following Sunday. But I'm going to give you these books so you can finish them and I don't have to. This one, we're having a hard time getting for you. And I got several unfinished things in this one. Maybe I can finish this one, this particular one tonight. We'll see. Charlene was about 19. She was a tall, thin brunette with blue eyes that put out a fierce, penetrating gaze. When I attempted to shake hands with the girl, she backed away and stared distrustfully at me, keeping track of every move I made. Ed's telling this story. Bringing these two people out to my office, I asked Charlene to take the chair beside my desk while her father sat in an easy chair close by. I then switched on the tape recorder and asked Mr. Rand to state the problem again. He repeated that whenever he or his wife spoke to their daughter, they could never be sure if they were talking to Charlene or to some alien personality. The girl, all the while, never took her eyes off me. When the father was done, I attempted to question the girl. "Who are you?" I asked. "Charlene Rand," she answered contemptuously. "How old are you?" "Older than you think," she said. "How about what your father told me? Is it true you've been manifesting different personalities?" "He's paranoid," she answered. "I'm myself. I'm whoever I want to be." "Are any of your personalities inhuman?" I pressed her. "I don't have to answer any of your GD questions," she shot back. Only she didn't use letters. When I looked up to ask Charlene another question, she was directing one of her piercing eyes at me, or piercing gazes at me. Better put my glasses on. That threw me for a minute. I was wondering where the other eye was going. Better bring this a little closer. When I looked up to ask Charlene another question, she was directing one of her piercing gazes at me. "You picked the wrong guy to try that on," I told her. "Don't you ever do that to me again." For the first time since she entered our house, the girl looked away from me. She seemed dazed and disoriented, as though she'd just been clunked on the head with a baseball bat. Her eyes wandered over the articles on my desk, then came to rest on the black lace veil that I'd put in the far corner to stop the spirit from manifesting. Suddenly, before it could block her, Charlene jumped up, grabbed the veil, and drew it to her breast. Her features immediately began to transform into those of a wild, sneering creature, distinct from this otherwise attractive girl. I drew two vials of water to myself, one unblessed, the other blessed, by a very pious exorcist, and moved away from what was no longer Charlene, but an inhuman spirit, a lesser devil of hell. "This," says Ed, pushing the play button of the tape recorder, "is what I heard." And he played it for the author of this book. Raucous, diabolical laughter suddenly erupted from the twin bookshelf speakers. "You're laughing at me," Ed's voice says. "But who am I talking to?" And because it was in his office, the custom of Ed is to tape record these conferences. He got it down. "You're laughing at me," Ed's voice says. "Who am I talking to?" And the spirit that possessed Charlene began to speak. "Voice, I know who you are. Ha, 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 he. Ed, who are you? Ho, ho. Who are you?" Ed said. "Voice, don't you know me? Ha, don't you know me? Oh, come on, you know who I am. Don't you know who I am? I'm suffering, I'm suffering." "Why are you suffering?" "Ho, ho, hee, hee. Black is my color. It's the color of death, the color of death, the color of death." "Ed, who sent you here?" "Voice, I worship Diane and Lucifer and light, light, light. Everything holy is damned." "Ed, I have something for you." Voice defiantly. "What have you got for me that I don't already possess? I can possess anybody that I want, you..." An explicative. "Ed, I'll put it on your hand and you tell me what it is." Testing the entity, Ed puts unblessed water on Charlene's hand. Voice. "Ooh, it's wet." "Ed, that's right." Voice, "It's wet and I don't like it." "I like blood. I like to see blood. I like to drink blood." "Ed, I have something else for you. I have holy water for you." Voice, "Holy water? Holy what? You're no man of God." "Ed, no, I'm not." Voice, "You're in between, aren't you?" "Ed, that's right, in between." Voice, "You don't know. He stands in hell or heaven. There's not a hell and there's not a heaven. No, there's not a hell and there's not a heaven. There's just a place, and I won't tell you that place now, will I? You know, don't you? You know you're standing between heaven and hell. There's no heaven or hell, and you're going to get it." "Ed, no. You're the one who's going to get it." Diabolical laughter rings out for 10 seconds. "I like this. Do you know that? It gives me peace. It gives me peace, and I like peace. I like peace and to be quiet, but I don't like you." Screams followed. "Ed, I know why you don't like me." Voice screaming, enraged. "Why?" "Ed, you don't have Lonnie to possess anymore, do you?" Voice cackling. "I have anyone I want to have. I'm stronger than you and your man of God, that exorcist." "Ed, we'll see. We'll see who's the strongest. What's your name? What do you call yourself?" Voice, "Let me put it this way, man." Vulgarity follows. "I'm a favorite of Lucifer. Do you know who Lucifer is?" "Ed, you tell me, who is Lucifer?" "Ha, ha, ha, ha. He's the one God who's right, you know. When I want something, I can have it. I can have what I want." "Ed, you wanted Lonnie, but you couldn't keep her." Voice, "Ho, ho, ho. Lonnie doesn't know. Lonnie doesn't know." "Ed, what doesn't she know?" "Voice, she will drink the blood. She'll drink the blood and she'll see me. I'll possess her again." "Ed, again. Is that what you're saying, again?" Voice, adamantly, "Again." "Ed, no, she won't." Voice, shouting, By what means are you going to protect that girl? She's mine. Her soul is mine. Ed, nothing of her belongs to you. I will suck the blood out of her, the voice said. Ed, you'll do nothing to her. Voice, ha ha, I like her. She's my toy. Ed, she was your toy until she came to me, but you'd like to get even with me, wouldn't you? Voice cackling and laughing. I can do anything I want to do. For just a moment. Let me take the Bible again. New Testament, Gospel of Mark, fifth chapter. They came over unto the other side of the sea into the county of the Gadarenes. And when he was come out of the ship, immediately there met him out of the tombs a man with an unclean spirit, who had his dwellings among the tombs. No man could bind him, no, not with chains, because that he had been often bound with fetters and chains, and the chains had been plucked asunder by him, and fetters broken in pieces, neither could any man tame him. And always, night and day, he was in the mountains and in the tombs, crying and cutting himself with stones. But when he saw Jesus afar off, he ran and worshipped him, and cried with a loud voice, and said, What have I to do with thee, Jesus, thou Son of the Most High God? I assure thee by God that thou torment me not. For he said unto him, Come out of the man, thou unclean spirit. And he asked him, What is thy name? And he answered, not the boy, saying, My name is Legion, for we are many. And he besought him much that he would not send them away out of the country. Now there were near, nigh unto the mountains, a great herd of swine feeding. And all the devils besought him, saying, Send us into the swine, that we may enter into them. You believe in the New Testament? This demoniac-possessed boy certainly talked through the possessed one in the Gospel of Mark. I can do anything I want to do, the voice said. You'll do nothing, Ed said. I have something that is stronger than you'll ever be. You know that too, don't you? Voice, oh yes. You believe in such false things? Oh, what's that? Ed, you tried to come to me the other night. What did you intend to do? I drove you off, didn't I? Voice, I wanted to kill you, and I really meant it. Unintelligible screeching followed on the tape. Then, are you going to stick something in my heart? I don't have a heart. Ed, that's right. You don't have a heart. Voice, no. Ed, I'll give you something else. Ed cast holy water on the possessed. You don't like that very much, do you? Ed said. Voice, and rage, screaming, No! Ed, you like the sign of the cross? Voice, No! Ed, all right, now I'm going to tell you something. Voice, violent screaming. Ed, I want you to leave. And I don't want you ever to come back here again. Voice, stop it! No, I won't stop it. In the name of God, you're going to leave. Voice screaming violently. In the name of Jesus Christ, shut up! head. It will be in the name of Jesus Christ, and you will leave and you won't come back again. Voice. I shall return, or if I do not return, one stronger will. I'm weak, there are others stronger. Head, you're weak, all right, and you'll go, and I'll drive you off. In the name of God, I'll drive you off. Voice. Ha, 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 he. Head, here's something else for you to think about. Head anointed the possessed girl with the holy water and the sign of the cross. Voice, agonized screeching. Oh, my God, fire! Fire, fire, fire! Head above the screeching and wailing. I don't want you to come back to this house again. Do you understand me? Voice, oh, my God, oh, my God, oh, oh, my God, oh. Head, I don't want you ever to come back to this house again. Now, leave! Leave! Baleful moanings, caterwaulings, and various animal sounds are then heard receding into the distance as the possessing entity withdraws from the body of the girl. Ed puts an end to the moaning by hitting the stop button on the tape recorder, leaving the museum room as silent as a dungeon. After a long moment of reflection, Ed finally breaks the silence. That's what's out there. That's what's possessing these kids. Inhuman, demonic spirits, inhuman because they're not man and have no positive virtues, demonic because they're an order of angels that call themselves devils, and spirits because they do not exist on the physical but on the metaphysical plane. They're invisible, but they're there. Did the spirit actually return to possess Lonnie? Oh, my God, yes, Ed replied immediately. No more than a week later, her boyfriend called on the phone and told me what had happened. The girl drank the blood offering once again, just like the spirit said would happen. And she came right back under possession with the same entity. I want to tell you something. Time Life's now offering. I don't know if it's advertised nationwide, but they have their own series on witchcraft, including how to, if the ads are right, put spells together and other such things. I'm ordering one. You better let me read it first. It's one thing to read about these things in the books we're giving you. It's another thing to get the formulas that enable you to actually engage in some of the activity. I wouldn't want them laying around my house, particularly if you have children. Now, I've ordered one. I'm going to go through them for whatever it's worth to you, because this is serious business. Everybody in the nation watches me at the leadership level, and whatever I get on, people try to surfboard on the subject. But I'm telling you, don't order those things unless you know how to deal with demons. You've been listening. You know this is no area to mess around. The girl drank the blood offering again, just like the spirit said would happen. She came right back under possession with the same entity. Ed says, I had to go all the way back to the college, confront the entity, and again arrange for Lonnie to be freed through exorcism. Why didn't the first exorcism on Lonnie work? It did, says Ed, but it takes the person's cooperation for an exorcism to be totally effective. The exorcist restored the girl's free will, but the spirit oppressed her will again. Rather than fighting the temptation, she went ahead and drank the blood offering. A week later, this opened her will back up and gave the spirit permission it needed to return and possess her body one more time. Did the spirit possess Lonnie a third time? No, she's free today. What about Charlene? What became of her? You're not interested. I can tell you. The place is dead tonight. I can tell. No, I think you are interested, and I think you're listening. But I have no idea that whether we even joined. The rest of the stations. I came on reading. You interested in this subject? I'm not going to lose my credibility and have people think I'm a nut, I keep saying as I read about this. I think it's a subject we better deal with intelligently. But I need some response. January 4th to 5th. George grabbed the lion off the living room table and threw it into a garbage can outside the house. Would you like to do that to a lion? Only it was a porcelain lion. They made a movie out of this. But you couldn't possibly make a movie out of this unless you understood the biblical doctrine of demons. Now, I've left it for a few weeks, but I begin teaching on demonology. I started by reading the book, The Demonologist, about the Catholic lay demonologists, Ed and Lorraine Warren. We then skipped to the Philippines and read the story, not yet completed, of the little girl in Dilibad prison on the front pages of the Manila newspapers day after day, bitten by demons in her cell. Too hot in here. I then read the story of John Wesley's household and their poltergeist experience. We then read sections of the book, The Devil in Connecticut, where Arne Johnson in Connecticut, in compassion for the little boy that was being exorcised, cried out to the demon, "Leave him, come into me," for fear the boy would die in the exorcism experience. Apparently it did. Arne Johnson's defense for a subsequent murder, he didn't do it. And he's in prison in New England today. We got into this after a prelude that brought us in the back door. The strange happenings in and around the Bermuda Triangle. We also just touched at shamanism, if you remember. There's a whole series of books I've brought in here each night on shamanism. The purpose in all that I'm saying is to have a gestalt settle in. If you look around, there's evidence of unseen beings, unseen forces, that confirm the biblical description of reality. I spent this afternoon rereading again, among other things, but I quickly went through Reinhold Niebuhr's Lyman Beecher lectures. He refined them through two other lectureships, published it in the book Faith and History, dealing with the problem of modern society's inability to come to grips with what's going on in the 20th century. And as he does so adequately, he capsulized history in broad strokes and the philosophy that governed it. The classical views of history, which were but a westernized expression of the Oriental view of history that looks at it as a constantly changing wheel of life. And the ideal was to somehow identify with unchanging reality above it all and escape from it and the cycles of nature were seen as synonymous with the cycles of history. Both of them either cyclical or chaotic and incapable of being ordered, you just escape from it or learn to endure it stoically. Beginning with Augustine's City of God, and lots of people in the modern world fail to realize the influence that churchmen had on the way man thought and looked at his world. Kings, for centuries, were under the influence of churchmen. Augustine's purpose was almost identical to the purpose that Paul or whomever he used in the writing of the book of Hebrews was. To tell those Hebrew Christians, as the temple would be crushed and Hebrew worship services destroyed, there was something unchanging and much better to hang on to. And as the Roman Empire began to fall apart, Augustine's voice set the foundation for the centuries that followed, that the church would endure and even rise and be stronger, though the empire would fall, as he talked to the city of God. But Augustine introduced the biblical Christian view of things, that what is really wrong with this world is man himself and his sinning tendency, and introduced again the biblical concept until the Renaissance. The Renaissance destroyed the biblical concept's hold on history by introducing, and out of the Renaissance came the viewpoint of the 18th and 19th centuries, which was commonly shared on all sides of the philosophic and political thinkers of the world. A basic faith in history. Reason takes over. Science expands man's freedom and power, and everything can be analyzed, categorized, understood, and controlled by man. And the Messiah, or Christ, is history itself. We are, as evolution, moving ever forward. Whether it's the communist idea that encompasses crises and catastrophe periodically, but the dialectical process would make the redemption come out of the wreck, and each wreck produces the seeds of the next phase of the spiral that is an improvement over the last, and the rationale for revolutions is thereby offered by the improvement on history that occurs in this spiral. Basically, a faith that history was moving ever forward, and as man expanded his freedom and his power, history could be analyzed, social sciences could be analyzed just like natural sciences, and man could learn to control his destiny, and education, the application of reason, would put man totally in control. And everything was within the domain of man until 1914. By the way, the pyramid marks that date too, when it all blew apart. And man discovered that history was not moving by some inevitable force toward a better life. And our expanding knowledge has put in our hands the frightening ability to destroy ourselves. And the Bible, once again, is to the forefront, as even newsmen who know nothing about it are talking about Armageddon. The biblical answer is the last expression of sin will be the worst, so man isn't going to get better. And whatever Antichrist means, it means the last sinner is the worst one. And the answer to history comes from beyond history, not in history. The Creator must provide the answer and split the heavens and come to clean house on evil and set up His kingdom as Prince of Peace, King of Kings, and Lord of Lords. I'm in the business of proving the Bible right in every dimension. And man has been so wrong in other areas, likewise he's wrong in the area of these supernatural forces. And it's time that somebody coldly, non-emotionally, and without peddling cheap fear, analyze demonology and the evidences there too. I'll be right back. Welcome to those that have just joined us. Turn the lights down. It's a little too cold in here now. I'm back to telling ghost stories again. Some of you ate too much. You need to have a bad dream. On February 5th, 1976, the 10 o'clock news on New York's Channel 5 announced it was doing a series on people who claim to have extrasensory powers. The program cut to reporter Steve Bowman investigating an allegedly haunted house in Amityville, Long Island. I've read this, but I want to just very quickly set the stage and go back to where George grabbed the lion. Bauman said that on November 13, 1974, a large colonial house at 112 Ocean Avenue had been the scene of a mass murder. 24-year-old Ronald DeFeo had taken a high-powered rifle and methodically shot to death his parents, two brothers, and two sisters. DeFeo had subsequently been sentenced to life imprisonment. 2 months ago, the report continued, the house was sold for $80,000 to a couple named George and Kathleen Lutz. They were aware of the killings, not superstitious, and rather delighted that they were getting such a bargain on a house that was worth more, still too cold. And they began legitimately to think that might be why the price was low, but not being superstitious, they moved in. They made a movie of this story, but not a very good movie. You need to read the book. And I'm reading in the context of a broad survey that I've been doing off and on of evidence, a lot of it, for happenings in the invisible world that don't have a natural explanation. Turn it off. Tonight I tell you to turn it on. When I read ghost stories, I want it warm in the house. Now, we've read of poltergeists in John Wesley's house, the devil in Connecticut, the work of the demonologists, Ed and Lorraine Warren from West Point to Connecticut. Now, they were called in on this Amityville horror case, and it was while Ed Warren was writing his report in his office, a little cottage attached to his home, that the attack occurred, which was the opening story I read as I read from the demonologist. Now, we're still trying to get the book. Order while you're young. Craig Lamp is working on the demonologist, but I will say in his defense, Prentice Hall apparently will not print the hardback. And we absolutely cannot even get Berkeley Press in New York. In fact, if any of my New York listeners can find Berkeley Press in New York City and find anybody in, I wish you'd go over there and tell them there's some people in California that want to buy some books. It's the strangest publishing house I've ever heard of. They don't want to sell and they don't want to publish. When we called them first, they had 500 copies. Then we called them second, they said they had plenty. We could have them. We called them third, and they said, no, they made a mistake. They only had 400 copies, and those were sold. We said, well, we'll pay to print 10,000. I believe Craig has talked to two or three different people. And we just get shuffled from phone to phone, room to room. Nobody wants to sell books, I guess. But you mark it down, sometime before the rapture, we'll get it. Because I have faith, even Craig can get it before next September, and I know the rapture, if it occurs in 75, won't occur till September. 85. Well, nothing like stacking your bets, because, you know, if somebody had bet on me, I'd have said it didn't occur in September 75, did it? They bought the house, and immediately strange things started happening. Now, I haven't yet, except brief references of Scripture, indicated an explanation. The reality of a hierarchy of evil, invisible forces capable of manifesting, that the Bible would suggest, not suggest, say, represents fallen angels, a hierarchy of them with various levels of assignment, just like an army, that with Satan fell. Cast out of the heavenlies. No, not really. Cast out of their original position in heaven, but still prince of the power of the air. One day to be cast totally out of the heavenlies. We have suggested the possibility that demons just might be those aberrations, bodiless spirits representing the dead offspring of that illicit mating that Genesis 6 refers to when the sons of God mated with the daughters of men. No question but what the Bible suggests, and why I keep saying suggested, speaks of these unseen demonic forces. I'm merely looking at modern evidence of happenings that cannot have any other explanation except otherworldly. Preternatural would be the word Ed and Lorraine would use. Ed and Lorraine Warren. Supernatural or demonic beings. After strange happenings, including the moving without explanation of a large porcelain lion that caused George, the husband in this household, to stumble over it one night and hurt himself. And now he's going to throw it out in the garbage can. George, when the happenings began, researched the original ownership of the house, found it was built over a place that the Indians had felt were inhabited by devils. It had a long history in addition to the murder in the DeFeo household. Now it's too hot. We're up to January 4th. They moved in some 20 days earlier, I guess. George grabbed the lion off the living room table. Why is it when I come here some nights that thing can blow and you hardly hear it? Tonight it sounds like a tornado across the plains of Texas. Doesn't it? Now, is it my imagination or is it loud? What in the world is the matter with that thing? It's eerie. George grabbed the lion off the living room table, threw it into a garbage can outside the house. Too many lights in here. Turn one off. Yeah, that's a little better. George grabbed the lion off the living room table and threw it into a garbage can outside the house. It took him quite a while to calm Kathy down because he couldn't possibly explain how the porcelain piece had managed to come back down from the sewing room where they had placed it after its first bit of traveling. She insisted that something in the house had done it and didn't want to spend another minute at 112 Orange Ocean Avenue. George had confided to Kathy that he too felt uneasy about the lion's sudden reappearance. They had moved it up to the sewing room. Here it is, back down the living room. But he couldn't agree on running away without taking a chance at fighting back. Well, how can we? You fight what you can't see, Kathy asked. This thing can do anything it wants. No, honey, George said. There's no way you can convince me a lot of this isn't just our imagination. I just don't believe in spooks. No way, no how, no time. Finally, he talked Kathy into going up to bed with a promise that if he couldn't get help by the next day, they would get out of the house for a while. They both were completely drained. Kathy fell asleep out of sheer exhaustion. George dozed off, waking every once in a while to listen groggily for any unnatural noises in the house. He says he had no idea how long he had lain there before he heard the marching music downstairs. His head was keeping time to the drum beats before he realized he was listening to music. Glancing at Kathy to see if she had been awakened, he heard her breathe deeply. She was fast asleep. George ran out of the room into the hall and heard the stomp of marching feet get louder. There must be at least 50 musicians parading around on the first floor, he thought. But the moment he hit the bottom step and turned on the hall light, the sound ceased. George froze on the staircase, his eyes and head swiveling frantically to catch any sign of movement. Can you turn that one on and turn this one off? Or do they have to go together? This is eerie. Is that one on? Is that one on? Is it on? Then leave it alone. Just plain eerie, that's what it is. I don't like it either. I don't like it at all. Am I boring you? I haven't told a ghost story in a while. I'm getting out of practice. She was fast asleep. George ran out of the room into the hall, heard the stomp of marching feet get louder. There must be at least 50 musicians parading around on the first floor, he thought. But the moment he hit the bottom step and turned on the hall light, sound ceased. George froze on the staircase. I would too. His eyes and head swiveling frantically to catch any sign of movement. Well, 50 musicians, you know, you ought to see something. There was absolutely no one there. It was as though he'd walked into an echo chamber. After the cacophony of sound, the sudden silence sent chills up his back. Then George heard heavy breathing, thought someone was right behind him, spun around, no one was there. He then realized he listened to Kathy from all the way upstairs. Fear of her being alone in the bedroom galvanized George. He raced back up the steps two at a time into his room, turned on the light. There, floating 2 feet above the bed, was Kathy. She was slowly drifting away from him toward the windows. Kathy! Kathy! George yelled, jumping up on the bed to grab his wife. She was as stiff as a board in his hand, but her drifting stopped. George felt a resistance to his pull. raced back up the stairs two at a time into his room. I'll read this again. Turn on the light. That's really what gets you. There, floating 2 feet above the bed, was Kathy. She was slowly drifting away from him toward the windows. I don't believe this. I just don't believe this. Why do I keep reading these things I don't believe? Huh? George yelled, jumping up on the bed to grab his wife. She was stiff as a board in his hands, but her drifting stopped. George felt a resistance to his pull. Then, a sudden release of pressure, and he and Kathy fell heavily off the bed onto the floor. The fall awakened her. When she saw where she was, Kathy was incoherent for a moment. "Where am I?" she cried. "What happened?" George started to help her up. She could hardly stand. "It's nothing," he reassured her. "You were having a dream and fell out of bed, that's all." Let me tell you something. It ain't wise to lie when you're dealing with these people, or these persons. He maybe didn't want to scare his wife, but Kathy was still too dazed to question George any further. She said, "Oh," meekly got back into bed and immediately fell into a deep sleep. George turned out the light in the room but did not return to his wife's side. He sat on a chair beside the window, watching Kathy and looking out into the lightning sky of early morning. Father Mancuso, the priest that had been trying to get to help him, was also watching the new day break from his mother's house in Nassau, where he had gone shortly after the altercation with his pastor. Not because he was afraid of a continued outburst, but it had been impossible to sleep in his stench-filled, incense-smoked apartment. He'd had a fight with his pastor because that terrible smell of excrement was only in his apartment at the little monastery. And they tried to kill it with incense, got nowhere. And the mixture of the two had driven him out. He now truly believed that he was the target of the demonic phenomenon and thought that the odor would go if he left the rectory for a while. First, Father Mancuso had misgivings about being in his mother's home because he didn't want to involve her in his problem. Then he began to feel feverish and decided if he was to be sick again, he'd rather be under her care. He hadn't had much sleep and awakened a few minutes before dawn. He felt his palms itching and looked at his hands to examine both sides. He considered talking to his mother as he noticed the blisters on his hand, and said, "I didn't want to worry her." She was already concerned about his illness. He sat up till 7 o'clock. "I'd like to call George Lutz," he thought, "and find out if the mass caused any similar reaction in his house." But he postponed it. 10 in the morning, Kathy was still in a deep sleep. George had become worried about her condition. He decided to call Father Mancuso. He dialed the father's private number, no answer. Called the rectory, was informed that Mancuso, the father, was visiting his mother, and they couldn't give out her number, but would give Father Mancuso the message that George had called. "These people are desperately seeking help." Huh? Let's go on. They don't have much luck getting Father Mancuso. They waited for him when he was supposed to come one night after they'd set up an appointment. It was almost 11. The father didn't come. And when George realized that Father Mancuso wasn't coming that night, and I skipped over a lot of pages of Father Mancuso having recurring bouts with sickness and itching blisters on his hands and backing out of taking on the demonic force, and the Lutz is helplessly waiting and hoping he'd come and believing he would. This night was another such night, and he didn't. George realized that Father Mancuso wasn't coming that night. Kathy had been drooping in her chair for the past hour, her eyes closing with the warmth of the fire. Finally, she announced to George she's going to bed. George looked at his wife. Not once had she mentioned getting away from the house. It was as though none of the frightening incidents had ever occurred, and it was just natural for her to want to go to sleep. They went up to their bedroom together. Kathy mumbled she was too sleepy to take a bath or do it in the morning. She was asleep as soon as her head hit the pillow. George sat on the edge of the bed for a while watching Kathy breathe deeply. Then he went out to check on Harry. The dog was asleep again, his food untouched. George was about to reach down and shake the animal when he heard the marching band strike up in his house. He ran back in through the kitchen. The drums and horns were blasting away in the living room. George heard the stomping of many feet as he tore through the hallway. The lights were still on, but he could see there was no one in the house. The very instant he could see into the living room, the music had cut off. George looked about wildly. USOBs. And he didn't know that he couldn't be more accurate. Sons of Belial. Where are you? He screamed. George took in great gulps of air. Then he realized there was something strange about the living room. Every piece of furniture had been moved. The rug had been rolled back. Chairs, couch, and tables had been pushed against the walls as if to make room for a lot of dancers or a marching band. The next story opens with Father Mancuso appealing to the chancellor to try to get them to approve dealing with the problems in the Lutz house, because Catholic regulations required official approval, official exorcists, and an official pattern in the act of exorcism. The end of his appeal to the chancellor. Chancellor Ryan cleared up his throat and looked kindly at the priest. You're not to return to that house. You can call the Lutzes and tell them what we suggested, namely some parapsychologists and others to look at them. But under no circumstances are you ever to go there again. I thought you said I shouldn't consider a belief in such matters as this, Father Mancuso protested. Yes, I did, said Father Ryan, the chancellor, but you've got yourself so worked up over this affair that at the moment, the best thing you can do is disassociate yourself from the Lutzes and 112 Ocean Avenue. They're on their own now. After breakfast, Kathy dropped the boys off at their new school, then drove over to her mother's house with Missy. George was alone in the house. He'd gone down to the cellar to clear the odor with two fans. But when he came down the stairs, there was no trace of any of the terrible stench that had made him vomit the day before. Remember, I read that. He sniffed but could find nothing, even when he went directly to the secret red room. George pulled the plywood paneling back open, flashed his light about the red walls. Damn, he said, it couldn't have disappeared just like that. There's got to be an air hole down here somewhere. Search as he could find no source of the terrible stench of the day before. January 6th to 7th. Earlier that day, am I boring you?
No, sir.
Earlier that day, Kathy had returned from her mother's house in time to pick up Danny and Chris at their new school in Amityville. The whole family ate together at 6:30. After they finished dinner, I'm leaving some places. Gotta go. They went to bed. 2 a.m., George began to yawn, his eyes getting heavy, his body getting stiff from lying in one position. A short while ago, he looked over his shoulder at Kathy. She was still flat on her back, her mouth open, snoring. Suddenly, George had an urge to get up and go to the witch's roof for a beer. In the darkness of the room, George could see Kathy. Wait a minute, let me go on. He knew there were cans of beer in the refrigerator, but he kept thinking they wouldn't slake his thirst. It had to be the witch's brew. It didn't matter if it was 2 in the morning, it was freezing. He turned to wake Kathy and tell her he was going out for a while. In the darkness of the room, George could see Kathy wasn't in bed. He could see she was levitating again, almost a foot above him, drifting away from him. Instinctively, George reached out and gotta leave. You that I'm on a long time, you're lucky. I'll be right back. It's the devil. You want me to finish? I don't think anybody wants me to continue. You better get on the phone. could see she was levitating again, almost a foot above him, drifting away from him. I don't believe this. What do you read it for? Because it's true. Instinctively, George reached out, grabbed her hair, and yanked. Kathy floated back to him and then fell back onto the bed. She awoke. George turned on the nightstand light next to him and gasped. He was looking at a 90-year-old woman. The hair wild, a shocking white. The face a mass of wrinkles and ugly lines. And saliva dripping from the toothless mouth. George was so revolted he wanted to flee from the room. Kathy's eyes, set deep in the wrinkles, were looking at him questioningly. George shuddered. It's Kathy, he thought. This is my wife. What in the hell am I doing? You want to hear that again? He wanted to go to the Witch's Brew for a beer, local bar. Now, don't let anybody comfort themselves by talking to you in here. No fair. You're scared. Tying up my phone all night. In the darkness of the room, he could see Kathy wasn't in bed. She's levitating. Instinctively, he reached out and grabbed her hair and yanked. She floated back to him, then fell back on the bed and awoke. George turned on the nightstand light next to him and gasped. He was looking at a 90-year-old woman. The hair wild, a shocking white. The face a mass of wrinkles and ugly lines. And saliva dripping from the toothless mouth. Now, if you have not made your reservation for my banquet, you still can. They're answering at King's House 1. They're all alone over there and it's cold and they need some comfort. And if you have made a reservation and you have not had a call back to confirm it, will you call right now so we can confirm it tonight? George turned on the nightstand light next to him and gasped. He was looking at a 90-year-old woman. The hair wild, a shocking white. Close that door. Too light in here. The face a mass of wrinkles and ugly lines. And saliva dripping from the toothless mouth. George was so revolted he wanted to flee from the room. Wouldn't you? Kathy's eyes, set deep in the wrinkles, were looking at him questioningly. George shuddered. It's Kathy. It's Kathy, he thought. This is my wife. What the hell am I doing? Kathy sensed the fright in her husband's face. My God, what does he see? She leaped from the bed and ran into the bathroom, flicking on the light above the mirror. Staring at her own face, she screamed. The ancient crone George had seen was gone. Her hair was upset, but it was blonde again. Her lips were not drooling any longer, nor was she wrinkled. But deep, ugly lines ran up and down her cheeks. George, following Kathy into the bathroom, peered over her shoulder at the image. He, too, saw that the 90-year-old visage had faded, but the long black slashes still cut deeply down Kathy's face. What's happening to my face? Kathy yelled. She turned to George, and he put his fingers up to Kathy's mouth. Her lips were dry and burning hot. Then he ran his fingertips gently along the deep ridges. There were three on each cheek, extending from just below her eyes down to just under the jawline. I don't know, baby, he whispered. George took a towel from the rack next to the sink and tried to wipe the lines away. Kathy spun about, looked into the mirror. Her scared face stared back at her. Running her own fingers down her face, she began to cry. Kathy's helplessness stirred George deeply, and he put his hands on her shoulders. "I'm going to call Father Mancuso right now," he said. Kathy shook her head. "No, we mustn't involve him in this." She looked at George's face reflected in the mirror. "Something tells me we could get hurt, or he could get hurt. We better go and check on the kids," she said calmly. The children were all right, but George and Kathy were unable to go back to sleep that night. Every once in a while, Kathy would hold her hands to her face, checking to see and feel if the ridges were still there. Finally, the cold dawn broke. The snow had stopped, and there was just enough light for George to make out Kathy when she touched him on the shoulder. "George," she said, "look at my face." He turned from his position he had taken in the chair near the window and looked at his wife. In the dawn's weak light, George could see that the lines were gone. He put his fingers up to her face and touched her skin. It was soft again, with absolutely no trace of the disturbing scars. "They're gone, baby," he smiled gently. "They're all gone." In spite of what Kathy had said during the night, George called Father Mancuso in the morning and caught the priest just before he went to early Mass. George told him he had spoken to North Carolina, where Jerry Sulfin had promised to have an investigator come to the house immediately. Then he brought up the incident of the night before. Father Mancuso was aghast about the second levitation and the alterations of Kathy's face. "George," he said urgently, "I'm worried about what could happen next. Why don't you just get out of that house for a while?" George assured the priest he'd been thinking of doing just that, but first he wanted to see what Francine, the medium, had to say. Maybe she could help, as she had claimed. "A medium?" Father Mancuso asked. "What are you talking about, George? That's not scientific investigation." "But she said she can talk to spirits," George protested. "In fact, Father, do you know what she said yesterday? She told me there's a well hidden under my house." "She's right. I found one under the stoop, and she's never even been here." Father Mancuso became angry. "Listen," he shouted over the phone, "you're involved in something dangerous. I don't know what's going on in your house, but you better get out." "You mean just leave everything?" "Yes, just go for a while," the priest persisted. "I'll talk to the chancellors again and see if they can send someone, maybe a priest." George was silent. He had been trying to get Father Mancuso to his house and been refused time and again. The priest's superiors had done nothing but suggest he contact some organization. Finally, he had someone who sounded if she could actually help him. And Kathy, the medium. "Why, she did just leave everything and walk out." "I'll tell Kathy, Father," George finally said. "Thanks." He was about to hang up. "George, there's one more thing," said Father Mancuso. "I seem to recall that you and Kathy were in transcendental meditation at one time." "Yes, that's right." "Do you still practice that?" the priest asked. "No." "Well, yes. Well, we haven't really kept it up since we moved here. Why?" "I was just curious, George. That's all," Father Mancuso replied. "I'm glad you're not doing it now. It might have been making you susceptible." Right after talking with George, Father Mancuso called the chancery at Rockville Center. Unfortunately, Chancellors Ryan and Nuncio were unavailable, and their secretary could only promise to have them called the following day. Isn't only the government has bureaucracy. The priest was extremely agitated and prayed that things would not continue to deteriorate until the church could bring its forces to bear against the evil that gripped 112 Ocean Avenue. "Do you want this book?"
"Yes, sir."
"I want to give this book at the banquet. So I don't have to finish, do I?" In his compassion for the Lutz's plight, Father Mancuso forgot about his own dilemma, but in a few minutes he was violently reminded that he too was subject to the unrelenting influence. He began to shiver and shake. His stomach heaved and his throat tightened. The priest sneezed and his eyes watered. He sneezed again and saw blood on the tissue. Chancellor Ryan's warning, "Don't involve yourself anymore," flashed across his mind. But it was too late. Father Mancuso had all the signs of another attack. Later that evening, Eric, the young engineer who worked at George's company, arrived at the Lutz's home with his girlfriend, Francine, the medium. George immediately hustled the young couple out of the bitter cold and into the living room to warm themselves in front of the big fire. They brought an infectious cheerfulness that had been missing at 112 Ocean Avenue. George and Kathy responded, and soon the four were chatting away like old friends. But under George's exterior warmth, there was an urgency. He wanted Francine to look over the house. As he was trying to turn the conversation around to her experience with spirits, Francine beat him to it. Suddenly, she got up from her seat on the couch and motioned to George. "Put your hand gently over here," she said. George bent over and waved his hand where she had pointed. "Do you feel the cold air?" Francine asked. "Slightly," George answered. "She's been sitting here. Now she's left. Now follow the couch. Feel it over here?" George put his hand near the pillow. "Oh, yeah, it feels warm." Francine beckoned George and Kathy to follow her. The three entered the dining room while Eric remained in the living room with the fireplace. Francine stood next to the big table. "There's an unusual odor here," she said. "I can't quite place it, but it's here." "Whew. You smell that?" George sniffed. "Yeah, right here. It's the smell of perspiration." "Perspiration." The girl headed for the kitchen but hesitated before going into the breakfast nook. "There's an old man and an old lady. They are lost spirits. Do you smell the perfume?" Kathy's eyes widened. Quickly she looked at George, who shrugged. "Evidently these people must have had the house at one time," Francine continued. "But they died. Only I don't think they died in the house." She turned to George and said, "I want to go to the basement now, okay?" When George had first spoken to Francine on the telephone, he told her that mysterious things were happening in his house. But without ever really spelling out what the phenomena were, nor what had actually taken place with Kathy and himself. He hadn't discussed the touchings in the kitchen or the smell of perfume Kathy had experienced. In any case, Francine had said she'd rather draw her own conclusions after visiting the house and, quote, "talking to the spirits who live there," end quote. I warn you. Now, Francine descended the stairs to the cellar. "The house is built on a burial ground or something like that," she said. She pointed to a large area of the basement where the storage closets were built. "Is that new?" she asked George. "I don't think so," he answered. "As far as I know, it was built all at the same time." Francine stopped in front of the closets. "There are people buried right here. Something is over them. There's an unusual odor. This should not be stuffy at all like this." She was pointing directly at the plywood paneling that hid the secret room. "Notice the chill?" Her hands were moving now, touching the wood. "Somebody was murdered, or he could even be buried under here, but this seems like a new part, like a new part has been added on over this grave." Kathy wanted to run from the basement. Her husband noticed her discomfort and reached for her hand. Francine solved their dilemma. "I don't like this spot at all. It's better we go upstairs now." Without waiting for a response, she turned and headed for the basement staircase. As they went up to the second floor, Francine's boyfriend, Eric, joined them. She stood in the hallway, holding onto the banister. "I have to say that when I came up here, there was a whirling sensation. I felt a tightness on the right half of my chest." "A pain?" Kathy asked. Francine nodded. Very slight, very quick, right as you turn the corner. It disappeared quickly. She stepped to the closed door of the sewing room. "You've been having problems in here." George and Kathy both nodded. He opened the door, half expecting to find the flies in the room, but there were none. And he and Francine walked inside. Kathy and Eric hung back in the doorway. Suddenly, Francine appeared to go into a trance. Out of her mouth came a different voice, heavier, more masculine. Quote, "I would like to make one suggestion to you. Most people find out who their spirits are and they find they like them. They don't want them to get lost or to go away, but in this case I find this house should be cleared or exercised." End quote. The voice coming from Francine began to sound familiar to George. He couldn't quite place it, but he was sure he'd heard it before. "Somebody's little girl and boys. I see blood stains. Somebody hurt themselves badly here. Somebody tried to kill themselves or something." After that masculine voice, Francine came out of her trance. "I'd like to go now," she announced to George and Kathy. "It's not a good time to try to talk to the spirits. I have a feeling I should go. I was born with a Venetian veil, you know." George didn't know what she meant, but she promised George to return in a day or so when the vibrations are better, she explained. The couple departed almost immediately. Big help. Back in the living room, George and Kathy were silent for a long time. Finally, Kathy asked, "What do you think?" "I don't know," George answered. "I just don't know. She was hitting things right on the head." He stood up to put out the fire. "I'll have to think about it for a while." Kathy went upstairs to check on the children. Again, Harry was staying with the boys since it was too cold out even for a rugged dog. George made his usual check of all the doors and locks, then turned out the lights on the first floor. He went up the steps to his bedroom, then stopped. Before he reached the second floor landing, George saw I'm going to give this away at my banquet. Don't have to finish. You say, "Well, I'm not coming to the banquet." It's your problem, isn't it? Well, but, you know, the Bonaventure in Los Angeles is a fur piece. Further than going fishing. Well, but I'll give it away at the banquet I have in your town. Why aren't you making tentative reservations for the banquet in your town? Well, because I don't know where it's going to be. Well, neither do I. But I'll know before I go. And you'll know before you go. When I have 120 people reserved, tentative, we'll pick a place and a time and tell you, right here. Now, why aren't you making your reservation? Then you get this book and don't have to finish. You can read it for yourself. Am I frustrating you? And if it wasn't legal, then the lawyers, they would sue. He went up the steps to his bedroom, then stopped before he reached
the second floor landing. George saw. He went up the steps to his bedroom, then stopped. Before he reached the second floor landing, just before the second floor landing, George saw that the banister above him was wrenched from its moorings, torn almost completely off the floor foundation. At that very instant, at that very instant, if you come to my banquet, you get this book. You can read it. It's on page 199. Amityville Horror, True Story of Jay Hansen. I'm going to give it to you at my banquet. At that very instant, he recalled whose voice had been speaking to him through Francine. It was Father Mancuso. We're leaving some people. An hour to finish, too. Now, I'm not leaving everybody. I could keep going if I got some calls. If I got some calls, I could be persuaded. I'm sort of enjoying the story myself. Any phones ringing? We'll pick them up and see. I can be persuaded. But you got to beg me a little. You got to tell me how wonderful I am. Want me to read this ghost story any further tonight? Get on a telephone.